We see a number of spheres in the World Trade Center dust that look like this. As, again, as I mentioned, the Stardust Hotel does have this appearance as well. And the thought comes to mind, well, maybe all this, these spheres are from the cleanup. But I'll answer that question. You're right. You have to think about possibilities. Maybe the cleanup, as they cut through steel, they generated dust spheres. And somehow those, in fact, this is the trouble. Is one of the problems. It's not the only one. How do those little spheres get all the way over to Jeanette McKinley's apartment from the cleanup? And by the way, in the first week or so, get over there to get into her apartment to appear in large numbers. But that's something we'll deal with a little more later, which we can rule out the cleanup theory. Okay, here's an example of a sphere which we found. It's about 1.5 millimeters. And I saw this by eye, along with some of these metal, shiny spheres and drop. This one was very drop-like, you know, more like a carrot shape almost, but clearly molten, smooth surface and so on. This one does appear also to be hollow, by the way, as you look at it. Okay, on the right, this is that particular sphere on the right, and here's the steel. Now, this is one of the reasons we can eliminate the origin of these spheres as being from just cleanup, because then it should be steel, right, which looks like this. It's very simple. Iron, manganese, not much else. Oxygen, of course, you're melting this in air. Carbon, by the way, I'll just mention because I see it there and I like to answer questions in advance. We put these samples on carbon tape, so there is going to be some carbon background, which is not too significant here. But look at in the sphere what we see in addition to what we see in steel. Aha, there's more. There's sulfur and aluminum and copper. And when I saw the aluminum in there mixed with iron, and especially with the sulfur added on, I thought, oh my goodness, I know how to do this. I know how to make these spheres using, who knows, what's the chemical? Thermate, good for you, thermate, okay. You guys are way ahead of me. So aluminothermic reaction, which I'll just call thermite. If you add sulfur to make it cut through steel, we use the term thermate for that. And that's how I'm using that term, thermate. There is a particular military version, thermate TH3, but I'm just using it generically. Or thermite plus sulfur. So what you do is you take aluminum powder, mix it with metal oxides, iron oxide, copper oxide are very typically used. What happens is the oxygen is transferred in the chemical reaction over to the aluminum. Aluminum wants that oxygen, and enormous amounts of energy then, heat, are released during this chemical reaction. If you want the reaction to go fairly slowly, second or two, you use just a fine powder. If you use an ultra fine powder, then this mixture becomes explosive. So there is an explosive form of thermite based on nano aluminum, and that is called super thermite. I'll leave that up for a minute for those chemists in the audience. Do we have any chemists here? Not necessarily. Yes. Okay, good for you. So there's your formula. I warn you that this reaction is dangerous and should only be done by a trained professional such as myself. I'm not a chemist, but I started out actually in chemistry and physics. Well, chemistry is kind of a subset of physics, you know. So that's a joke for chemists. Okay. Okay. How did I get this formula? Well, I remember I showed you what I saw here. I saw iron, copper, sulfur and aluminum. So I put those in. By the way, another spot on this sphere shows some zinc too. So I put a little zinc nitrate in here and I mix that up. I was just guessing. I saw a lot of sulfur, quite a bit of copper. So I put quite a bit in there. Now when you run a mix like this, plus I had done thermite experiments now. I'd been doing experiments, not with so much copper and so on in there, but I had done some. So I had a feel for what it might be to match the World Trade Center dust. When you do thermite experiments or thermate with sulfur added, you get a flow of the hot molten metal, mostly iron, some aluminum. The aluminum oxide mostly comes off in this white ash. In addition, you see sparks. And those sparks, because of the molten metal, will form many of them then into spheres. And I collected the spheres. I have just an optical photograph here showing you some of the spheres. Okay, now we can try to compare. How did I do? Which one of these can you tell is from the World Trade Center dust, and which was is from a thermate that I mixed up in trying to... Now, there are some differences, of course. I didn't get it perfect. But you notice the aluminum, sulfur, kind of similar. Yeah, about the right aspect. There is one way to tell, actually, which is the thermate and which is the World Trade Center dust, and that is from the date. Because I mixed up and ran the thermate after on the 15th of March and the sphere we looked at on the 7th of March. So that's how you can really tell. Folks, this, to me, is one of the more persuasive arguments. Not only we... I mean, I used to get asked, people say, well, if there are explosives used in these buildings, then there should be some residue. Come back when you have residue. I'm back. Okay? I'm here. All right. Death. All right. Now, for thoroughness, as we try to be then as scientists, I reiterate that iron-rich spheres were seen in the dust in the Stardust Hotel. None of those had aluminum that we saw. We didn't see too many. In the World Trade Center dust, there seems to be a lot of these steel-like spheres and also a small percentage of the iron-aluminum-like spheres. Okay? This is what you might expect then. And by the way, it's not necessarily, I need to emphasize, not necessarily just the thermite reaction that was used. It's very possible. And I expect other forms of explosives were used in addition to the thermite. We ground up some World Trade Center concrete. As I mentioned, Jeanette had these chunks of concrete. Ground that up, looking for spheres. Is it possible that somehow the spheres were in the concrete released during the demolition, right? You got to think and check all these possibilities. We didn't see any, no iron-rich spheres there. By the way, I added this afternoon, just reflecting back for Dr. Moray's talk, we did not see any uranium spheres. She did show some spheres with uranium, depleted uranium. We didn't see any such spheres in the dust. Now, I can't rule them out. We've only looked at a couple hundred. There are other groups in particular. I'll show you some R.J. Lee data coming up. That is, they have looked at tens of thousands of spheres. We would like to be able to see their data. I sent a sample of the dust to a friend at Cornell, and he had it analyzed. They also see significant iron and aluminum. Not as much aluminum as the sphere I showed you. Okay, here's USGS, a photograph in their report, the World Trade Center Particle Atlas, as I recall, is the name of it. It's available online. And I have obtained more information from the USGS by Freedom of Information Act action. It wasn't too informative, at least, but it was interesting to go through that process. They did send us some more of their data, which wasn't published. But they do note, and they have a photo of this, well, it's not a photo, it's an electron microscope image of this iron-rich sphere. So these definitely exist. You also see this now in the R.J. Lee report. This is a company that looked at the dust extensively. And the reason they did, they're working for an insurance company trying to determine just if insurance should be paid out. This was for the Deutsche Bank, which was damaged heavily. And, gosh, I think the insurance company ought to be interested in this, you know, as I think about it. So let's look at the R.J. Lee report just a little bit. Here's some spherical, this is from their report, spherical iron particles. You see the arrow, there's four that they point to there. And here's the chemical profile, iron, yes, I've seen that before. Now let's quote from the report. This is another, it's called vesicular, they'll define it here. Some particles show evidence of being exposed to a conflagration, such as spherical metals and silicates. Remember the glassy and the metallic spheres. And vesicular particles. What are these? Round, open, porous structures having a Swiss cheese appearance as a result of boiling and evaporation. Folks, to boil metals requires high temperatures. Okay. Not reachable by burning jet fuel or, you know, office materials in a fire like that. The presence of these particles identifies the source as the World Trade Center event. They point out that it's unusual. I mean, this is unique. I mean, it's World Trade Center stuff when you have these types of objects, the vesicular in particular. Okay, how do they explain the spheres? Various metals, most notably iron and lead. We also see lead and copper and a few of the tin and a few of the things. Various metals were melted during the World Trade Center event, producing spherical metallic particles. Exposure of phases to high heat results in spherical particles due to surface tension, as we discussed before. Of course, that's the only explanation to get all those metallic spheres and glassy spheres as well. Particles of materials that had been modified by exposure to high temperature, such as spherical particles of iron and silicates, are common in World Trade Center dust. Now, here's their explanation. Because of the fire that accompanied the World Trade Center event. No, surely. Most of the time they just say, well, it's unusual. So here they slip it in. They say it's the fire. No, won't work. The insurance company should have gone, no, we're not accepting that. But are not common in normal interior office dust, which they compared. Of course, that is true. You just don't find these types of... There are micrometeorites, by the way. I try to be thorough as a scientist, but they are very uncommon. Okay, and they also have things like silicon, and so on. We've looked at some of those as well. Here's another characteristic of the dust, which I had not seen. By the way, I'd seen the glassy and the iron-rich spheres before I dug into this report, which another scientist, Dr. Jenkins, to his credit, called to my attention that I needed to look at it again and notice these aspects. So, it has to do with evaporated lead. Now, lead evaporates at 1749 centigrade. Let me pause there. What's the maximum temperature, air temperature from these fires? 1100. Okay, 1100 would be the maximum. Okay, so here we're 1749 is the evaporation temperature for lead boiling. Ah, way high. An additional characteristic, this is quoting from the R.J. Lee report. An additional characteristic of World Trade Center dust is the presence of coated particles and fibers. The presence of lead oxide on the surface of mineral wool indicate the existence of extremely high temperatures during the collapse, which caused metallic lead to volatilize, evaporate, oxidize, and finally condense on the surface of mineral wool. Man, red flags are going off all over the and whistles all over the place, aren't they? How do you get these high temperatures in the World Trade Center situation with just fires? Ha. Well, there is an answer. Let's look at the data here for a minute. Just reviewing, temperatures above 1,500 to melt iron, over 1,700 to get evaporated lead, which they observe these coatings. Maximum temperature of the fire is 1,100. I can tell you're a quick group, good class. The lead-coated fibers, the glassy spheres, by the way, are not from cutting steel during cleanup. I can just hear the debunkers already saying, oh, it's all cleanup. Well, you know, they cut through steel during cleanup. They don't cut through glassy fibers, you know, okay. You just move those out of the way. But there's a lot of these glassy fibers and spheres in the dust and collected soon after the collapse, you see. Aha, so we have another smoking gun, even without the aluminum. This mystery, this obvious data that's staring us now in the face, these high temperatures indicate a high temperature reaction of some sort. Very high temperature, over 1,700 degrees for the lead coating. So what can do that? Oh, one more thing. This is from the NIST report. We're talking about the temperature from the fires being max and the air temperature 1,100. But the steel, this is now from their model, the maximum temperature of the steel is about 600 centigrade. 600, man, that's nowhere near. It's at 1,500 plus to melt steel. 1,700 plus to melt the, or evaporate the lead. They're nowhere near those temperatures. Now, if we could just get the NIST guys to talk the RJ Lee guys, but surely the RJ Lee guys must have recognized this. Oh, I just brought up a slide here from one of the towers reminding you of the 47 steel core columns, the 240 perimeter columns. You could put a bonfire down here if you wanted. I don't think that flammable office materials were piled up next to the steel columns to make the fire hotter there, but you could go ahead and do that. The puppy is not going to melt and spray iron particles all over. I mean, I have a wood-burning stove. It happens to be steel, and I'm not worried about that thing melting. I just don't worry about that. That's me. I also have a kerosene-burning stove. Jet fuel is a type of kerosene, and I'm not worried about that puppy melting either, you see. It just doesn't reach those temperatures. So, there we go. Let's see, I'm going the wrong way. Da-da-da. Okay, so the answer, how can we get there, is some explosive and or incendiary, an example of which, not the only, C4 is another example, RDX, HMX. An example is thermite, which does answer a number of questions. High temperatures, the aluminum observed, the flow of orange hot material, which NIST, to their credit, does report. To the discredit of NIST, they don't explain very well how this orange material could flow out of the South Tower, right near where the building fails in just minutes. But by the way, iron, we say, now here, you guys are sharp. So here's this orange material. Orange, I'll tell you, has a temperature of about 950 centigrade. There's a correlation there in temperature and color. You see on your stove, red hot is about 600 centigrade. And orange hot is about 950. So the question is, but steel doesn't melt till 1500. So how can you have molten iron? How does that work? We have a problem. But no, there's an answer. If you add sulfur, remember the sulfur? If you add sulfur to iron and iron oxide, you get what's called a eutectic, and the temperature where it stays a liquid is right around 940 with this eutectic, you see? So you can have orange hot with iron as long as you add steel. And Jerry Lobdell has written a paper very recently in the Journal of 9/11 Studies. You can read more about that. This is a technical point, but see, things fit. They fit. Thermite, probably other explosives, spheres of rich in iron plus the glassy spheres. And we can just, all this data is just coming together, telling us that there were explosives planted, and we even have some of this residue then. I mean, I think it's just overwhelmingly compelling now. And I'm working with a number of scientists, of course, around the world on this. I want to add just a little more while we're at it, because John asked me, is there anything new? I don't know if you've seen this picture, John. Before, tell me, have you seen this picture? This is from World Trade Center 7. No, good. So this is new for you and most of you, I'm sure. This is from a report, this slide. I took from a report from the Worcester Polytechnic Institute group again, and they asked the question. Here's their question. Can a microstructural examination of the steel give insight into why World Trade Center 7 collapsed? They are worried about this problem too, the official guys, as they should be. Severely eroded flange beam from World Trade Center 7. And the composition of the steel, you see, there's 0.05% sulfur. That's almost nothing. You can't have too much sulfur in steel. It makes it brittle, weak. So they look at the steel, at this eroded portion, and what do they see? Here's iron. And what's this? Sulfur. See the S on there? Yeah. Anyway, that's sulfur. There's an S up there. Enormous peak. And they ask the question, where does the sulfur come from? Remember, this is an official World Trade Center 7 steel sample with sulfur in it. I rest my case. Yeah, I rest my case. You see what I'm saying? I rest my case. But being a scientist, I have to check a few other things. So someone suggested, in fact, I think it was Frank Greening, he's Canadian, said, well, maybe it's just sulfate somehow. So I looked at the steel they provided. I just noticed this recently. This is called a digital X-ray map. It shows you the bright areas are where the sulfur is, you see, and the dark areas are where there isn't much sulfur, so you see the bright. And what I want to, and here's a lot of iron here, not so much iron there, clearly. Not much silicon anywhere. Oxygen, you'll notice where the sulfur is bright, that's where the oxygen is little. So I believe that rules out very strongly sulfate being SO4, which should have four times as many oxygen atoms as sulfur atoms if it's sulfate. Nope, it looks like sulfur. By the way, we have found in the slag from the World Trade Center, slicing it, a pore in there which contains elemental sulfur. So that'll be reported later, more formally. But this is all fitting together with the thermate picture. And by the way, here's again from the WPI report. You see a large sulfur peak in the steel and copper. Oh my goodness, where does copper and sulfur come from? Thermate, you see, using copper oxide. So we're still studying that, but that does look like an explanation for that. Now, the code in the United States, NFPA 921, for fire. Was there fire at World Trade Center? Yes, of course. So here's what you're supposed to do. Unusual residues might remain from the initial fuel starting the fire. This is for arson investigation. Those residues could arise from thermite, etc. Now, this is the standard for these investigations. When you find traces of thermite, you say, aha, there was a crime committed here. Someone was inside the building planting this highly dangerous chemical. It's not something you want to store in your house, by the way. Although you can buy it on eBay, turns out. Thermite. Add your own sulfur. You can get anything on. I mean, the same guy that was threatening me, you remember, when I came out with the thermite discussion, which was at a scientific meeting a year ago, April, and that got in the newspaper, immediately emailed to me, don't you dare talk about thermite. You might tell the terrorists something they don't know. And they'll, you know. And I'm saying, look, we demonstrate thermite in chemistry classes, physical science classes. I've demonstrated it, you know, in a physics class, and it's just a very well-known, common reaction, goes back about 100 years, and you can buy it on eBay. So, I mean, you know, my case. By the way, once you find it, you still don't know who did the action, right? That takes more investigation. But you know that a crime was committed. You can say, now we have cause, we need a criminal investigation and trial. That's the stage we're at now, I believe. Okay, now from the NIST, Frequently Asked Questions, in August of last year, the question was raised, someone's been reading our papers. Was the steel tested for explosives or thermite residues? The combination of thermite and sulfur, called thermate, slices through steel like a hot knife through butter. An expression that I have used. The answer from NIST, NIST did not test for the residue of these compounds in the steel. Why not? You see? There's a deficiency there. I just point out that thermite has been found in fires before. Now, watch closely a demonstration of a thermite cutter, which you can buy cutting through a metal rod. So, one more time. It goes very quickly, a fraction of a second, and you can buy these, and they do sell them, they say, for demolition. I'm not saying it's commonly used that way, but this company wishes they would be used more commonly. Let's see. I do want to show this. This just came out recently through, again, this 9/11 Truth Community, a photo which I hadn't seen before. This particular piece of steel looks like there's been some cutting at the bolt holes. That is a clever place to put thermite, you know, at the bolt holes where you have, you could even remove a bolt, but you could just put the thermite there. Seems like that would be a good place to cut. Well, we're pursuing this. I just want to point out this is a very active research area, and results will be in the journal. Pop quiz, we'll skip tonight because of time. Aren't you glad I was going to have this pop quiz? It's just a review. Okay. Point number four. This will be shorter. Billions approximately made on put options. So let's read what Bloomberg News reported about this. And again, this is one that I find as I go around talking to groups, I find that people are just incensed that someone is some people, others, are making money off the deaths that occurred on 9/11. Let's see the evidence for that. Trading in so-called put options, which rise in value when stocks fall. So in other words, you buy a put option, it's a way to make money when a stock falls. That's the mechanism. And you're betting the stock will go down, you make money. So trading in these put options surged as much as 285 times the previous average volume in American and United Airlines during the days before September 11th. Don Rattler. No similar trading in other airlines occurred on the Chicago Exchange in the days immediately preceding Black Tuesday, 9/11. Oh, so they figured these airlines, United and American, would go down. Now, which two airlines were involved in the hijackings? United and American only, right? Oh, my goodness. Okay. BBC. American authorities are investigating unusually large numbers of shares in airlines, United and American, insurance companies, and arms manufacturers. They believe that the sales were by people who knew about the impending disaster. Bloomberg News, this would be the most extraordinary coincidence in the history of mankind if it was a coincidence. See, people are saying, whoa, this can't be a coincidence. This could very well be insider trading. At the worst, most horrific, most evil use you've ever seen in your entire life. It's absolutely unprecedented. Now, somebody made a lot of money. The stocks, sure enough, on United and American Airlines went way down after 9/11. And Andreas von Bülow estimated the worldwide amount in these suspicious pre-9/11 trades, he estimated at $15 billion. It's a lot of money. Somebody just couldn't resist the temptation to make money off of this. It makes me sick again. The 9/11 Commission report does deal with this. In a footnote on page 499, we read, highly publicized allegations of insider trading in advance of 9/11 generally rest on reports of unusual pre-9/11 trading in companies whose stocks plummeted after the attacks. Some unusual trading did in fact occur. Okay, you can't deny that, so they admit it. But each such trade proved to have an innocuous explanation, no conceivable ties to Al-Qaeda. So what are you worried about? If Al-Qaeda is not involved, it's innocuous. It's perfectly innocent. Go away. Don't ask any more questions. They didn't reveal the names of the people. This is something we should like to know. Huh? So here's the... what I'd like to distinguish now, the 9/11 Commission method, which I would call the political method. This is somebody else's cartoon. I changed the title a little here. Here's the conclusion, which is Muslims alone did it. You see, that's the conclusion, Al-Qaeda. Here's the conclusions. What facts can we find to support it? And if there's any other facts, well, we just sort of, it's innocuous. I don't know. It's not Al-Qaeda. It's okay, go away. Yeah, you know. Scientific method says no. We look at all the facts, and then we draw our conclusions from them. As a human being and as a scientist, I'm appalled that the 9/11 Commission would take this narrow attitude rather than opening up the investigation beyond Al-Qaeda, which is what we are trying to do, folks. And I commend you for your participation in that effort. My fifth and final point, then, on what I think... is compelling is that officials are withholding data. Now, we've seen several cases already where 9/11 Commission has withheld or put blinders on these data. We would like to, let me remind you then, we just talked about the 9/11 trades on put options. We would like to, if it's innocuous, then why not tell us the names? Perhaps as a community, we can do some research on these people. Someone mentioned perhaps Dick Cheney did some trading. I don't know. But if he did, we could trace and see, you know, if perhaps he has some foreknowledge of the attacks and others. But I'm just, thank you for giving me an example. That's all that was. NIST is holding back videos and photos of the collapse of Building 7 despite FOIA requests. There's an example, again, of withholding data. We would like to see those released to us, to the public, and as a community, we will certainly look at them. We have a good group of people. The discussions that NIST had regarding the orange flowing material, the iron-rich microspheres, if they discussed it, let's see those discussions. Did they ever think about explosives? Now, NIST claims they say no evidence for explosives used. Well, these are evidences, and we would like to see if they actually discussed this. We have submitted, I and family members and the Scholars for 9/11 Truth and Justice group, what's called a request for correction with NIST, pointing out errors in their report. And, you know, immediately they wrote back and said, we acknowledge receipt. Since then, nothing, zip. The 60 days they have to respond with a correction or say, well, we're not going to correct it because, and so on. They haven't responded. They're outside the legal time. And so we'll see. It may be necessary to go through with a legal action to get NIST to respond according to the law. They need to do that. Here's another question I have. What hit the Pentagon? And I have not decided firmly on that myself. I'm waiting for videos, for data. You know, it's remarkable. With the towers, we have debris from the planes. We have videos, photographs. We don't have much of that, needless to say, with regard to the Pentagon. Furthermore, the FBI seized videos just after the Pentagon hit, whatever hit it, from the Sheraton Hotel, for example, Virginia Department of Transportation, as well as the Pentagon itself, which must have dozens of video cameras protecting their building there. So we're asking them to release the videos. Let us see what hit the Pentagon. I do want to show you, they have released a few frames, two frames which may show something. Here's one. You can't see much. All you can see is a little trail here, possibly the tail of a plane. Someone did a fit then, Russell Pickering did this analysis. If you put a 757, a Boeing plane, with that tail in there, it will stick out past this obstructing column, and you should see the plane. You don't see the plane in what they released. Highly suspicious. Fishy, again. Here's another one. This is lighter. I'm sorry the photo isn't better, but all you can see in the other frame that was released is just perhaps a nose of some flying object. If this were true, then it does appear that the plane, the 757, has these engines down low, should be cutting through the lawn, which is not the case. The lawn is actually pretty much in pristine condition after the collision. Certainly was not gouged. So we would like to see the release. If there's nothing to hide, why hide it? Right? Just give us the videotapes seized from the Sheraton Hotel, for example. I'm sure they would appreciate their tape back. So I want to point out, we do seek a real investigation. I've heard that repeated over and over. I've said it myself. But I'd like to point out that now, in the community, with the scientists, engineers, architects, chemists, they're scientists, yes, and so on, that we have gathered, lawyers, we have the experts to do our own investigation. What we need is the data. Now, it would be nice for some group, like the Parliament of Canada, for example, or to step up and say, well, we feel there should be an investigation. That would be great. I would hope that we could, even sooner than that, get these data. The withholding of these data becomes evidence against the official story, you see. What would I ask some of the officials? What data would we like to release? I'd like to ask Dick Cheney, what were these orders when he said, of course, the orders still stand? I'd like to see a release of his study on energy and oil. Some of you know about that study that he had done and which we know very little about, except some maps did come out through a legal action and showed maps of oil fields in the Middle East. Why were there no warnings, Mr. Cheney, to the folks inside the Pentagon who were killed, when you knew 50 miles out, at least that long, that the plane was something then was approaching? Exactly who is it that said, Angel is next? And Webster Tarpley talks about that in his book. I won't give detail here. But it's one, again, where initially the news reports were that someone had threatened the president. Angel is the code word, secret code word, for Air Force One, which changes, the code word changes. But at that day, it was Angel. Angel is next means Air Force One, therefore the president is threatened. Who issued that threat? All right? Who said it? Who reported the president? And why was it denied later? It was reported by Condoleezza Rice, for example, to the press, and then later the press secretary for the White House, was about 10 days later, Webster would know, denied it, said, oh, that was nothing. Or, you know, well, I'm sorry, we're not just forgetting that. It's important data. George Bush, how could you have seen the first plane hit before going into the Florida classroom, at which time we didn't know that the video of the first plane hitting, that would be the North Tower, we didn't even know video existed at that time. So how did you see it? Okay, let me quote. Here's a thoughts for questions for others. David Rockefeller, to the United Nations in 1994, said, "We are on the verge of global transformation. All we need is the right major crisis, and the nations will accept the New World Order." PNAC, Project for New American Century, September 2000. The process of transformation, since it brings revolutionary change, is likely to be a long one. Absent some catastrophic and catalyzing event like a new Pearl Harbor. You've heard that one. But did you know that this was presaged by Rockefeller? Yeah, this word transformation, I've noticed, is being used by certain members of the Bush-Cheney administration. And I'm a little concerned what they mean now by this transformation as I read Rockefeller and others. Rockefeller, in his book, I'd like to ask him about this. He writes, and this is in his memoirs, he's the author, so he's responsible. Some, and now quoting, "believe we are part of a secret cabal working against the best interests of the United States, characterizing my family and me as internationalists and of conspiring with others around the world to build a more integrated global and political economic structure, one world, if you will." Now, it sounds like he's going to deny it, right? "If that's the charge, I stand guilty, and I am proud of it." That's Rockefeller telling us, you know, what he's doing there. Both Presidents Bush, by the way, have politically spoken of the New World Order. Now the term usually used is globalization, which seems much more palatable, I think, but it seems to be the same program. Zbigniew Brzezinski said, "We cannot leap into world government in one quick step. The precondition for eventual globalization is progressive regionalization." So you form regions like the European Union and perhaps then the North American Union. You break down the sovereignty of countries and form these regions. The planner of the North American Union, it's generally credited to Robert Pastor, writing in the January-February 2004 issue of the Journal of the Council on Foreign Relations, CFR, says NAFTA was merely the first draft of a new constitution for North America. I don't know how you feel about that here, but I don't really want to see the sovereignty of these countries just given away in our constitutions with the rights. I know you have a statement of civil human rights as well. I don't want to just see those thrown out the window. People have talked about NAFTA. I just wanted to show a map of this. This is data. These data are available from Department of Commerce, the United States, is talking about this superhighway connecting from ports in Mexico on both Atlantic and Pacific right through Texas, Kansas City, and up into Winnipeg. Yes. And there are other routes, but this seems to be the central artery. There's one that goes up here to Ottawa. Now, again, I predict. How many of you like this idea? Oh, you wouldn't dare say. Okay. No, I think not. Okay. That we need to ask about this. We need to bring it out of hiding. We need to discuss it. In Texas, this I think is great, the Texas legislature got wind of this and is on record formally opposing the building of this highway, which I understand it started. They're not allowing it to be built through Texas. Is another 9/11 possible? Webster talked about that. It's an important point. Let me just quote a little bit. This is interesting because it's the Brzezinski again. And yet, Well, it's a very important event because earlier this year, February, before the U.S. Senate Committee on Foreign Relations, Brzezinski testified. And I'd be all over him asking questions, but the committee did not pester him on this one. The final destination on this downhill track, he's talking about the Middle Eastern wars, the 9/11 wars, is likely to be a head-on conflict with Iran and with much of the world of Islam at large. A plausible scenario for military collision with Iran involves Iraqi failure to meet the benchmarks, followed by accusations of Iranian responsibility for the failure. We're already seeing some of that, aren't we? Yeah. Then by some provocation in Iraq or a terrorist act in the United States blamed on Iran. Now, that's an interesting term he chose there. Accusations of Iranian responsibility blamed on Iran. You mean the United States would blame Iran unfairly? Why? This guy seems to be opening up, culminating in defensive. Now, he puts this is a PDF of his talk, and in quotation marks, defensive, you see, in quotation marks. Supposedly, then, defensive U.S. military action against Iran, the result, he's warning, that plunges a lonely America, I sure hope Canada would not join in such an attack on Iran, that plunges a lonely America into a spreading and deepening quagmire, much to be avoided. Now, what we're doing here is not a game. We are looking for justice and peace. I have listed what I think are the five strongest areas on which I hope the 9/11 truth community can be completely united, and on which, as I look at the official government conspiracy theorists who support that Muslim-only theory, you see, the Muslim hijackers did it only. Yeah. So I don't see them giving us much argument on these points. Some on the Building 7, to be sure, but our position there is very strong. Now, I would, again, the goal here is justice. I think we're ready to move to that step, don't you? With all these data now, we have a very strong position. Thank you for agreeing with me in that. We're working together as a community. It's certainly not just me. I'm just a rapporteur, in a sense, here. You see, when you get to the towers destruction, you find the official conspiracy theorists arguing left and right in internet discussions and papers. This is a recent preprint from Bezant et al., talking about how can you describe these squibs? Well, they call them air jets. Well, they talk about this upper block of floors in the North Tower, about 15 floors, falling as a sort of a plunger to generate air pressure to produce these squibs. And yet, look at this picture. Here, I mean, they say after the piston has fallen for a long distance, you see, like half plus of the height of the tower, you get air pressure, which allows you to get these air jets. But here we see the destruction zone way above and this air jet way below. Even this one is way down. This is a South Tower. This is the North Tower. Furthermore, these air jets appear, look at in both cases, here and here. Here we can't tell, but in the center of the face, which is what you expect for a squib generated by an explosive, because you have to attack the core, see, with these explosives. That's where you really have to pull out the strength. So you expect the squibs to be in the center of the face, as observed, certainly more than once. By the way, Kevin Ryan is writing a paper about these squibs. I think that's great. But again, when we talk about the tower's destruction, there's a lot of good work, but it's a field where there's a lot of mudslinging. I would call it, let's see if it's here, let me put it here. I call it the mud wrestling arena. So I didn't put it in my five, even though we have a very strong position there. This is where the official theorists like to play. It's where the no planes hit the towers theorists like to argue. And similar to the energy beams from space, even though I haven't heard a description of what type of beam, so that I can see if they have any sense there. The mini nuke theories, again, these arguments are applied to the towers, not to Building 7, as far as I can see. You know, the mini nukes. They're not talking about that in a tower. They're applying it to the... they're not applying these theories to Building 7, just to the tower's destruction. I do want to show you a couple things. Let's look at the actual first few seconds of the destruction of the North Tower. Does this upper block remain as a piston? Can you see? Here's the region where the fires were. No, it's being destroyed. The fires, the heat of the fire tends to rise. That's physics again. And you expect this. You expect the upper block to be weaker. Furthermore, the columns, the core columns, are getting smaller. That is, the steel is getting thinner as you go up. So this, again, would be weaker. It does not. The fact is, it does not remain as an integral piston going down. It's just contrary to the facts. How about being hit from space by some energy beam? Well, that must stop at the start at the tippy top, unless you have a beam that will skip down 15 floors. I need an explanation. How can a mini nuke do this? The same problem. You have to start where the planes went in. How do you do that with explosives? Easy. You put explosives every two or three floors, mostly in the core, by the way, as the engineers look at this. Gordon Ross has looked at this. And in the elevator shafts, you have access by accessing the elevators. We know there's a lot of elevator maintenance. And here I am in this arena of the tower's destruction. Okay, it's kind of fun to see. But the point is, this is where there's all this confusion. It's fine. I don't mind if others want to look at it. But I think if we take these areas on which we agree and press now for unity, we can achieve it. That's what I'm arguing tonight. Okay. I just want to show you this other very famous picture during the South Tower collapse. There appears to be this funnel cloud coming up, which has been argued as, again, an energy beam of some sort from space or a mini nuclear bomb. It looks kind of like a mushroom cloud. But this is pointed out by Greg Jenkins. Dr. Jenkins. If you look from a different angle, this is looking from the south. If you look from the west, what you see during the South Tower collapse is that there's a plume of smoke from the North Tower that is drifting to the south. Now just let's go over here to this view. You're looking at this plume, and as it drifts over you, and now you see it drifts over like that. Now move south, and it looks like it looks like this. That's all it is. That's the plume of the North Tower drifting over. So I hope you understand that. Okay, that's enough of that. That's why I didn't include the tower's destruction, although it's a very interesting and active area, but one which I think we don't need necessarily, you see, to get to justice. And when we get to some investigation, then we need to make sure they don't get us over in the tower's destruction where they have all these ideas, they being the debunkers, one sort or another. No, we need to face up to these issues where we have solid, compelling, repeatedly reinforcing data. Okay. Now I want to conclude with a few comments about what can we do. I've talked about some of these things before, but I've got some new things to add. We can prepare for difficulties. I am confident that we're making great strides in the 9/11 truth community, both in terms of numbers and in the availability of the data that we're generating. We're reaching a lot of people. However, there is a long way to go. And so I would recommend that you and I do some things to be prepared, and then we can go back to work. But once we're prepared, we are in pretty good shape. And that's because I'm concerned about you and my family. And I've recommended this to my family, and we're working on it. I've talked in the past about having enough food to last for about a year, 500 pounds of grain and beans per person. I recommend, in addition, a three-month food supply, which is the food you like to eat, whether that's macaroni or sprouts, you know. But you will have enough food to last for 3 months, and you're not under the thumb of the globalists who say whatever they want to say. If, you know, people get hungry, they get desperate. You will not be among the desperate because you will have food and clothing. Solar energy I've worked on for some time. Here's the funnel cooker that I have sent out now by the hundreds to people in developing countries. I'm a strong proponent of solar energy, and I did develop this cooker. The latest one set of solar cookers went to France on their way to Mozambique. And you can get the instructions for these on profjones.com. That it does have pointers to how to make the solar cooker if you wish to do so. You know, during World War II, they talked about victory gardens, right? So we have that degree of independence and self-reliance and resourcefulness. That's a good thing to work on. I'm glad that love has been mentioned several times already in this meeting. We need to help each other out if you want to come. Where I am, I have some food I will share with you. There is this international truth movement now. Individuals can and are doing a lot. I believe that the handing out of DVDs and literature, I mentioned my friend Jack, but I could here mention Webster Tarpley, Peter Dale Scott, Professor Griffin, and so on. These great books and DVDs. Pointing people to the journal. I remind you of your homework assignment then to read in the Journal of 9/11 Studies. Media, yeah. Again, with the Loose Change coming out, as I hope it will, as a movie, if we can get that out, that'll be a big wave that we need to move right along. Building local groups. You have a great group here in Vancouver. I noticed the same thing. It's great. Great group. There are great groups. You know, you notice the same thing. I think that's the strength of the movement, is it's a grassroots effort, and so we don't have any central committee or anything. We have these groups. Colorado has some great groups, and the Bay Area, Utah, has a kind of a fledgling group, but quite a few people that are just loosely connected. Courage, civility, and respect, of course, we need. I'm almost done. Okay, here's a thought that has come out. This came when I was visiting in Colorado, actually, discussions there. You see, these globalists, that's what they want, is this global control. I think that's fairly clear. So what do we do instead? We build a local infrastructure in which we are not dependent on Walmart, you see, for things. We shop at local stores wherever possible. I've identified store that works with farmers in our area, in our community in Utah, and so I like to shop at the local stores rather than the globalized stores. So we're bringing power back to the people, you see. In the United States, returning to the Constitution is something that I stress. And uniting with the impeachment and peace movements has been discussed at this conference. I think that's great. We need that unity, working together. Simplifying your life, getting out of debt, so we're not under the thumb of the international bankers. And again, bringing what savings you might have to local credit unions or perhaps silver and gold, that sort of thing. I just think these are wise things to do. Not fearful, but we just do them to prepare.
Physicist Stephen Jones speaking at the Vancouver 9/11 Truth Conference last June. Thanks to Drew Noftel for making DVD recordings of the conference material available to the show. Now to Dr. Jones' new revelations. This is a clip from his presentation on December 15th at the Boston Tea Party 9/11 Truth Conference.
Now here's the new discovery, the question I want to pose today. Could we find unreacted thermite in the World Trade Center dust? We see the residue. This is the smoking gun already, but can we find the gun, I guess you'd say? The unreacted thermite. Ta-da! Many red chips I found in the World Trade Center dust. About last June, I started noticing these. They're attracted by a magnet. A thought came, well, maybe it's just paint. There's all over these little red chips. They're like eggshell chips. You know, you scrunch up an eggshell. And you get about that thickness, roughly speaking. These are quite tough, though. They're strong. And now these are bilayered. This only shows one side, the red side. The other side is a dull gray. Red is the color of iron rust, iron oxide. One of the oxides, Fe2O3. It already suggests something to you. They're attracted by a magnet, suggests iron as well. And now the chemical composition, are you ready, of these chips, the red side. I won't talk much about the gray side. It's harder to analyze using this method. But the red side has, I just hardly wait to show you. Okay, here it is. These are red chips. The one is from the Liberty Apartment, McKinley. The other is from the Brooklyn Bridge sample. These also show, can you see it? It's very clear. Iron. Fe is iron. Si is silicon. Al is aluminum. K, potassium, very clearly. And, of course, oxygen. It's the same signature as the spheres. It's the same signature as the commercial thermite. I've put them side by side so that you can look at this. The same signature. Again, the amounts will vary from chip to chip and from sphere to sphere. And where you look on a chip, there are some variations. So here's a comparison now from the Brooklyn Bridge sample. Uncontaminated within 20 minutes of the collapse of the North Tower. The red chip is from the McKinley sample. The sphere, which is here, is from the Brooklyn Bridge sample. And so, but again, you see, from sample to sample, we see these, the same pattern. Okay, now this is from June, you see, of this year. This is the first time I've discussed these red chips publicly. I think it's important to get this out. We have done some other tests. One of the tests I did, so I took one of these red chips and had a friend scan. It's hard to get thermite to ignite. And I thought, how can we tell if this is thermite or not? It's not easy. It has the right chemical signature. Aluminum, iron, oxygen is what you need. And it's got some other goodies thrown in, silicon and potassium. And so typically, I put the K in parentheses. Not all of these show much potassium. But anyway, that's the signature. And so a friend of mine has an oxyacetylene torch with a very fine tip. He uses it for repairing eyeglasses. And so I had him pass it over one of these red chips. It was just 1/32nd of an inch on a side, approximately square. And it flamed, it flashed as he passed over it. Now, that's not itself a proof, but it's a strong indication, along with the chemical composition and the red color, which indicates iron oxide, that this is a form of thermite. I've provided red chip samples now to an independent laboratory for testing with the question to them, do they agree, do they find that these red chips are a form of thermite? Technical term is aluminothermic. Independently, Justin Keoff and his team, I know he's working with Richard Gage, is now also looking at the World Trade Center dust spheres and red chips also. Excited to say. Richard called up Justin last night. I talked to him on the phone. Oh, yeah, we saw some of that red stuff, you know. He said, we tried it in a Raman spectrograph system analysis. And he said, we hit it with a laser. Now, this stuff is behaving like thermite, folks. Again, I'm inviting scientific scrutiny of these red chips. I believe this is the last nail in the coffin, so to speak.
Thanks. That was Professor Stephen Jones with his latest findings proving the presence of explosives in the debris of the World Trade Center. Unwinding the lies of 9/11 is critical to a future of liberty and peace. Here are some links where you can inform yourself and others. Scholars for 9/11 Truth and Justice, Dr. Jones' organization. stj911.org with links to peer-reviewed research, and a general site with links to many other sites, 911truth.org, and another site for people wanting to take action, truthaction.org. Thank you for listening.